Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
So the Angolan facilitation has been very determined and has been very persistent, and we're extremely grateful for that because I think despite a lot of challenges, they have kept us all on track.
Angolan President João Lourenço plans to meet leaders from DRC and Rwanda on Sunday.
And having objected, the court agreed with us that that should be expunged from the record. It is surprising today that the decision they came to is based on that prayer which they expunged from the record.
Zambia's former president instructs his lawyers to challenge a decision by the Constitutional Court that bars him from contesting in future elections.
People are detained, including President Bazoum, but not only him. People are detained unlawfully with no basis, and the world, all the world, is calling for them to release President Bazoum.
And human and civil rights defenders demand the unconditional release of former Niger President Mohamed Bazoum from detention. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Democratic Republic of Congo's Minister of Foreign Affairs says the President of Angola, João Lourenço, plans to meet President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwandan President Paul Kagame on Sunday in the Angolan capital, Luanda. Therese Kayikwamba Wagner says the meetings form part of Angola's efforts to ease political tensions between the governments in Kinshasa and Kigali. The DRC has often accused Rwanda of backing the M23 rebels operating in the eastern part of the country. Rwanda denies the accusation. Human rights groups accuse the rebels of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. I had a wide-ranging sit-down interview with Therese Kayikwamba Wagner that included efforts by Angola to resolve the diplomatic tensions between the DRC and Rwanda. Here is part one of the conversation.
So the meeting, which is scheduled for December 15th, is a meeting between the three heads of state, as you mentioned, President Tshisekedi of the DRC, President Kagame from Rwanda, and that under the facilitation of His Excellency President João Lourenço of Angola, who is the AU-appointed facilitator for the Luanda process. So this meeting comes at the end, if you want, of a series of ministerial meetings that were all, you know, incremental efforts in the Luanda process that the Angolan government has spearheaded, a process that has as its main objective to diffuse tensions and to normalize relationships between the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Rwanda as a response to the dramatic humanitarian and security crisis in North Kivu province in eastern DRC, mainly characterized by the violation of our territorial integrity through the presence of Rwandan armed forces that are supporting the M23 militia.
So what has been the latest development concerning the mediation efforts by Angola? Because Angola prides itself by trying to help to mediate talks between the two countries, between Kinshasa and Kigali, to try to ease political tensions. How do you rate the efforts by Angola to try to resolve these tensions between your two countries?
So the Angolan facilitation has been very determined and has been very persistent, and we're extremely grateful for that because I think despite a lot of challenges, they have kept us all on track and have helped us reach some very important milestones in order to be able to progress towards what we hope will be the signature of an agreement between the different heads of state. There were a few important milestones. The first one was the entry into force of a ceasefire agreement signed by the DRC and Rwanda that entered into force on 4th of August and was had as main objective, obviously, as a ceasefire, to reduce tensions, to reduce the fighting, in order also to facilitate humanitarian access to a number of civilians who have been caught in the crossfire. Another important milestone was reached on November 5th when, again, the Angolan facilitation established a reinforced ad hoc verification mechanism, which is basically a team of experts from Angola, the DRC, and Rwanda that have as main objective and main mission to monitor the respect or the lack thereof of the ceasefire agreement. So two very important milestones. And throughout the past months, a series of ministerial meetings between the ministers of foreign affairs to make progress in the elaboration of a proposed peace agreement that we have been working on. So, as I said, there has been a strong dedication and commitment from the Angolan side to make progress on these issues. Of course, progress has been challenged every once in a while. When we look at the ceasefire, there have been repeated violations of the ceasefire that have been extremely concerning, which is why the verification mechanism was so important. Unfortunately, today, 35 days after the entry into force and the establishment of this verification mechanism, the DRC has sent its experts, or its experts were present on November 5th. Angola came with its experts on November 5th, but unfortunately, we have yet to see the Rwandan experts. So 35 days down the line, this very important mechanism that is supposed to monitor the respect of the ceasefire is not fully operational because, unfortunately, Rwanda has not sent its experts. So there have been a few situations like these that have marred the important progress that has been made.
Are you pleased with the mediation effort so far and the processes thereof? And what are your expectations after these leaders meet? What are your expectations and the outcomes that you expect, especially from Kinshasa?
I think what is important in such a delicate process is accountability. And this is our expectation towards the mediation, but also towards all of the partners that we have and that have been very committed and have been very forthcoming in the support of the mediation process and also in the promotion of a negotiated and cessation of hostilities. I think this is the moment where everyone who is concerned about sustainable peace in the Great Lakes region has to speak up to hold all the parties accountable. We're entering into a very critical phase where we move away from milestones towards an agreement, a legally binding document between heads of state. So this is not a small thing. And this is where we need a maximum of political mobilization, of political goodwill, and of everyone using the leverage to hold all the parties accountable. We have been missing that in the past months, because as I said, there is a ceasefire, it is being violated. As I said, there is a mechanism, it is not operational. So our expectation, whilst we move forward and whilst we escalate this to the level of heads of state, is that there is a greater accountability and that all of the parties, all of the partners, all of the entities that have spoken in favor of a diplomatic solution also hold all of the participants to the Luanda process accountable for their commitments. Otherwise, the whole effort will be jeopardized. There is a need for greater accountability. And the DRC is open to be held accountable. And we hope it is the same case for all the other stakeholders.
Therese Kayikwamba Wagner is the DRC's foreign affairs minister. She spoke with me from here in Washington. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. Zambia's former president Edgar Chagwa Lungu has instructed his lawyers to file a petition to challenge a decision by the Constitutional Court that bars him from running as a presidential candidate in the 2026 general election. In its ruling broadcast live, the Constitutional Court said Lungu is not eligible to contest the 2026 polls. He, however, rejects the court's decision as predetermined and politically motivated, contending that it undermines judicial integrity. But the government says the ruling that bars the former president from competing in future elections is victory for the rule of law. For more reaction to the Constitutional Court's ruling, I reach Makebi Zulu. He is a leading member of the former president's defense team.
Well, the instructions are firmly that we need to go back to the court and have them relook at their decision. Because in the first place, when the petitioner came in court, he asked for specific reliefs that the court was supposed to adjudicate upon. One of the reliefs that he sought was not included in the documents. And you know, legally, when you're going to ask the court to do something, it must be put in your document so that the other party is also aware of what's coming. You will note that during the proceedings, when the other party brought an issue or a question for the court to reverse its decision in the earlier matters, we objected to that particular prayer. And having objected, the court agreed with us that that should be expunged from the record. It is surprising today that the decision they came to is based on that prayer which they expunged from the record. Secondly, you will note that they are saying that for the 2021 election, he was eligible, but for this particular election, he's not eligible. It doesn't make sense.
Doesn't this defeat the purpose of judicial independence? If the same court on four occasions had ruled that the former president is qualified, then what has changed this time? Some of his critics
say. Exactly. What are the chances that they could be wrong four times and right this one time? That is the issue here. What are the chances that they were wrong the first time, the second, the third, and the fourth time, and this time around they are right? That is what is raising questions in this matter. And that is why it is difficult to add any credence to this particular judgment. It is very difficult because it has a lot of holes in it.
Does that mean that there's no finality when it comes to the Constitutional Court? Because where do you draw the line?
So they have told us that you can reopen the matter over and over and over and over again until you get a desired result. That is what they've told us. There's no finality whatsoever. And they've opened Pandora's box. We will explore that by keeping to go to them over the same question so that they, eventually they come back to their senses and say that matters must be settled with finality. They have defied that rule of law.
Some members of the Patriotic Front are saying the ruling by the Constitutional Court to prevent the former president from running in the next general election was predictable. But some others are also saying that the president has the constitutional mandate to constitute a court. He just did his constitutional duty. So the ruling was justified, they argue. How do you respond to that?
But the question is, should judgments change the moment they are new office bearers? If that is the precedent that we are setting for ourselves, then we are in for a rude shock. It means that even these particular judgments that are in place, the moment we change who the judges are, the moment we change the face of the court, then judgments will change as well. Should that be the case? I think not. Every reasonable person thinks not. This bad precedent that has been set should not be perpetuated in any way. Otherwise, our system will be unreliable and no one will want to take any matters to court, because court would seem to be deciding based on who's in power at a particular time and not based on the law.
What are the prospects of your court petition challenging the Constitutional Court's ruling that prevents the former president from seeking office again?
It's not whether or not the matter is going to succeed, but it's for purposes of pointing out the wrongs that have been done by way of this judgment and the difficulties that this particular judgment raises. Whether or not it will succeed, that's another issue altogether. But they have opened themselves up and there are issues that they ought to clarify. The fairness of the 2021 election has been brought into question now. Should we rely on the 2021 election? What is the legitimacy of President Hakainde Hichilema now? Since there was an imposter on the ballot paper, there was a person who should not have been there. Shouldn't the PF have been allowed to put a candidate who was eligible at that particular time? Should the PF go to court and say, you made a mistake, you lied to us, or you misled us four times and told us that he was eligible? Had you told us the first time that he wasn't, would have found another candidate and possibly won that election.
Makebe Zulu is a leading member of former Zambian President Lungu's defense team. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. December 7th marked 500 days since the overthrow of Mohamed Bazoum, the democratically elected president of Niger. Local news media reports say Bazoum is detained at the presidential palace along with his wife and son. This, as civil society and human rights defenders demand the release of the former president.
They are also calling on the international community as well as the World Bank and International Monetary Fund to impose targeted sanctions against members of the military junta. General Abdurrahmane Tchiani proclaimed himself the leader of a new military junta shortly after members of the Presidential Guard carried out a coup to topple the elected government in Niamey. For more on the calls for the unconditional release of the former president, I had a sit-down interview with the former Niger ambassador to the U.S., Kyari Liman Tinguri.
President Bazoum has been detained for 500 days now. This is not only unlawful, but it is just unjust and unjustifiable. There is no legal ground for this. There is no national security ground for this. The junta now has control over all the country and the power. They have been assuming power for 16 months now. So there is really no reason whatsoever to keep detaining President Bazoum. A matter of human rights. It's not a political matter, actually. As we speak, it's no longer a political matter. It's a matter of human rights. It's a matter of human dignity. And it's a matter of respect of basic rights for people. And the space of rights actually is shrinking in our country.
The military junta said that the core reason why he was overthrown was because of his failure to meet the aspirations of the people, including the ability to stop or to combat terrorists in the Sahel who have been attacking the people, and that he had failed to do that. That is the reason why they said he had to go.
Again, it's easy to demonstrate that this is a wrong claim, because what happens after the coup is just worse than the situation before when it comes to people's security. But we are no longer there. Now the situation is people are detained, including President Bazoum, but not only him. People are detained unlawfully with no basis, and the world, all the world, is calling for them to release President Bazoum. No longer than yesterday, a journalist who is a human rights activist was arrested with no legal base, with no warrant, and his family, wife and kids, were put in house arrest. His name is Musa Changari. So the human rights and the people's rights scape is shrinking in our country. And people all over the world are calling for the release of President Bazoum, unconditional release of President Bazoum. That's what I'm here to do also.
Talking about the relations with France and the United States, you were the ambassador of Niger to the U.S. here in Washington, D.C. What is the current state of relationship between Niamey and Washington, especially following the coup?
Current relation, I don't know. I don't know if there is any current relation, but by the press, as I am not in charge anymore. But what I can say is that it has been, after the coup, it has been at its worst since 1962, since the first basic cooperation agreement signed between newly independent Niger and the United States of America. Remember, the U.S. military were forced to leave illegally. There is no lawful base ground to ask them to quit. They have to do that. They have to abandon the base that was helping us to fight the terrorists, the jihadists.
Why do you think ECOWAS, mm-hmm. the Economic Community of West African State, for which, you know, Niger used to be a member until it decided to pull out, why hasn't ECOWAS been effective in engaging with the military junta for them to at least return or return the country to constitutional rule?
ECOWAS is now part of the enemies of the country, according to the local narrative, according to the propaganda on national TV, in addition to Nigeria, Benin, among the neighboring enemies, we have ECOWAS. So I don't think that ECOWAS is in a position to kind of make them, they have even decided to quit, to withdraw from from ECOWAS. So I don't think ECOWAS is in a position to call them to any reasonable path to development.
Kyarit Limantinguri is former Niger ambassador to the U.S. He spoke with me from here in Washington. In Ghana, the executive director and head of global research at Global Info Analytics says he feels vindicated about last week's presidential contest. The group's polling before the election indicated former President John Mahama would win with 52%, followed by incumbent Vice President Muhammadu Bawumia with 41.3%. They also show that prospective voters were concerned with major factors such as the economy, jobs, education, infrastructure, and the direction of the country. But Musa Dankwa was derided by critics as a fake pollster who was paid by Mahama's opposition National Democratic Congress, the NDC, for his organization's research. However, the Electoral Commission declared Mahama winner of the presidential vote with 56.55%, while Bawumia garnered 41%. For more reaction to the outcome of last week's election, I reach Musa Dankwa.
I really feel vindicated. And I also am elated because the team that worked hard to produce that kind of work also feel vindicated, and that they have not been lying after all to the country. So we all feel vindicated.
You were derided as fake, as a crank, as a fake pollster who was paid by the opposition party for you to do a pollster to reflect a positive outlook for them. With the results coming in, how is the reaction from your fellow pollsters and the community?
I think we've not had any reaction from them formally or officially. But, I mean, it is clear that the whole country has come to realization that ours was the only genuine poll that they had to rely on. And for us, that has given us the comfort that the people and the people, good people of Ghana do appreciate what we did for them.
How did you go by it that made it so accurate? Because there were a lot of polls that showed the ruling party was going to win decisively.
We've been doing this work for several years. And we've, over the period, refined our methodology to make sure that it adapts local conditions and consistently applying the same methodology in a very random way in terms of sampling. So we've done this work over the last 3 years, and we have a tracking data for all these months, every 90 days. And towards the end, we switched to telephone polls. So we have data that was consistent with what we were saying. And before the elections, we had been to several constituencies at least 3 or 4 times in the last 3 years. So we were not, polling blindly. We knew exactly what was happening. We knew the sentiment of the people. We knew the economy was going to be number one issue. And when you rank people's choices of who they would vote for in terms of the preferences, they tend to say that John Mahama was going to be the one they would vote for based on the economy.
I understand you have become like an overnight celebrity with all television and radio stations calling you to tell them how you went by it, especially when some people suggested that the attack you received could have destroyed your career as a pollster.
I mean, I feel very good. I mean, we've had several calls from eminent people in this country, CSOs, prominent people, really thanking us for the good work we did, because we provided the country with an objective assessment of the polling and where the race was. And that, I think, resulted in the country remaining calm. There was very little uncertainty as to the outcome for those who believe in our data. So when other things were saying otherwise, I don't think people really believed it. But they weren't quite sure whether we would be right as we came on.
Looking forward, what should Ghanaians expect from your organization in terms of accurate polling?
In fact, there were some lessons that we've learned from this experience, which we're going to take on board going forward. We're going to start polling again in the next 3 or 6 months. But this time around, focus on governance issues, performance of the government, standard of living, economic condition of voters, and we'll continue to do so until the political season returns. But we will remain the focal point or go-to for public opinion poll and market research in Ghana. in Africa.
Musa Dankwa is the executive director and head of global research at Global Info Analytics. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. A diplomatic and geopolitical analyst says the agreement between Ethiopia and Somalia marks a significant step toward resolving differences and de-escalating tensions. Brokered by Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the Ankara agreement aims to help resolve tensions between Mogadishu and Addis Ababa. Nur Mohammed Sheikh, who is also former spokesperson of the executive secretary of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, says it is critical for the Ethiopian and Somali leaders to implement the agreement in good faith to pave the way for peace and cooperation. Tensions between Somalia and Ethiopia erupted after Addis Ababa signed an agreement with Somaliland, a breakaway region of Somalia, to gain access to the sea. The move angered Somalia, which accused Ethiopia of undermining its sovereignty. For more reaction to Turkey's mediation efforts, I reach Nur Mohammed Sheikh in London.
Turkey's intervention in this area is not new. In July, Turkey convened the foreign ministers of Ethiopia and Somalia. Basically, they provided a platform to help them reach a mutually acceptable framework to find an amicable solution to the tension. There was deliberation at the time, and the two foreign ministers agreed to meet in September. The September meeting did not happen for one reason or another, but it's encouraging today's news that, you know, Turkey is convening, and at this time at the very highest level. We're talking about, you know, the meeting of the two heads of states, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud. So this is really very encouraging, and it also shows that the leaders of Ethiopia and Somalia are taking the Turkish mediation seriously. There are other initiatives, the East African Community and IGAD, both also were trying to bring these two leaders together. So let's see. There is optimism that, you know, normally when heads of state meet, there is a positive outcome.
Now, Nur, there are thoughts that there appears to be no political commitment to ending the tensions, in spite of efforts by regional bodies in the East African region or in Africa and Turkey. But do you see this as quite different?
I don't agree that there was no political commitment. What is there in public may show that, but there has been a lot of diplomatic back channel going on to bring the two leaders together. So President Ruto, President Museveni, President Gele of Djibouti were all working hard to bring these leaders together, and they have shown willingness at the time. I mean, Somalia has always been asking for Ethiopia to resign this MOU with Somaliland. Now that, you know, they are going to convene in Ankara, it really shows the seriousness with the two leaders are treating this this matter, and credit goes to Turkey, I mean, for really achieving this milestone.
No, do you think the mediation could go a long way to ease the political tension between Mogadishu and Addis Ababa and subsequently, you know, the entire region?
That is the objective of these talks, because, you know, everyone feels that the conflict in the region has a spillover, whether it is conflict in Sudan, with the spillover effect in the region, the conflict in South Sudan that was witnessed before the 2018 agreement, the political turmoil in Somalia. So normally, conflicts and tensions have spillover effect, and what Turkey is trying to do and what the East African community leaders are trying to do and IGAD leaders are trying to do is to preempt any you know, further escalation that they may degenerate into violence or conflict.
What should be the expectations of citizens from both countries following these tensions and the mediation efforts to ease them?
So the expectation from everyone, the citizens of the region, of the two countries, of the leadership of African countries, is that there will be an agreement between the two leaders in Ankara to resolve this matter once and for all. I don't want to speculate what the framework will look like, but given that, you know, a lot of diplomatic work has been going into this since IGAD convened the summit in January in Kampala, and the subsequent meetings and back-channel diplomacy, and the meeting and the foreign ministers meeting in Turkey in July, and now this meeting at the highest level, there is a lot of optimism that we shall have an agreement that then the leaders have to implement.
Nur Mohammed Sheikh is a diplomatic and geopolitical analyst and the former spokesperson of the executive secretary of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development. He spoke with me from London. In Nigeria, a group of nurses from the United States will be providing free medical care to the people of Lagos State beginning on Sunday. Organized by the Yoruba Nurses of North America, the yearly medical missions are aimed to promote healthcare, welfare, and to give back to the communities. Officials of the nurses group say key issues the mission will focus on include the limited access to primary health care, lack of health literacy, mental health challenges, as well as nursing training. For more on the medical mission, I reached Dr. Modupe Adebayo. She is the chairperson for the Board of Trustees of the Yoruba Nurses of North America.
Our goal is really to give back to our community back home. So in doing that, we actually target the main problem there, which is limited access to primary health care. And so primary health care really consists of taking care of people before they get sick. So we are not going to wait for people before they actually get sick. Similar to what we are familiar with here, where people will go to the clinic, they go for their immunization, they go for well child care, the adults will go for their annual physical just to make sure that everything is going on well. And then if there's anything that can potentially happen to them, it's already picked up before it actually gets to a situation where, you know, complications will happen.
There's also what some people say, the lack of health literacy in the communities. Yes. How do you plan on tackling this while you're on the ground?
So one of the things that we're going to do, aside from checking their blood pressure and their blood sugar, we're also going to do what we call counseling and education. So we will have an education table. So our education table is going to consist of, you know, education about diet, about lifestyle choices, about even predispositions to some of those conditions, based on whether they have a family history of it, or maybe even in their environment. So those are the things that we'll educate people about their diet and the impact of diet. We will also educate them about some of the choices, like, you know, do they engage in exercise? Do they also, engage in certain behaviors that can compromise their health, such as, you know, drinking and smoking, and even something as simple as hand washing? Because people don't even know that, you know, when you cultivate the habit of washing your hands all the time, you kind of reduce the number of your exposure to communicable, diseases or infections. Those are just one or two areas that we're going to address, but there are also other areas.
Talk to me about mental health challenges, because as you know, in a lot of African countries, they usually don't focus on mental health. Talk to me about that.
So because of the stressors, there are lots of stressors in our environment right now. I mean, and it's global, it's all over. People may find themselves unemployed. People may find themselves in different life challenges, family issues. But especially in Nigeria, where, you know, the cost of living is extremely high. People don't even have enough to feed their families. All these are sources of stressors. And because they are sources of stressors, people maladapt. And when we talk about maladaptation, people will turn to the wrong way to kind of relieve or to find succor to their problems. So with that, we want to kind of address some of those, because people don't understand that with the pain, that emotional pain, which is not physical pain, it takes a toll on the body. If you do not address emotional pain, then it manifests into physical pain, and then it can cause all of these other conditions in life, stroke, high blood pressure, and even heart failure, and those other conditions.
Talk to me about nursing training while you are there. Yes. And is your organization partnering any international organization to give more access to healthcare?
So nursing training is really very, very important, because as we know, diseases are not geographically bound, right? You cannot, for example, when, a disease does not know that, oh, this is Nigeria, this is US. So because of that, training has to also imbibe that as well. We have to thread that into training. So you don't just train people just for a specific, to take care of people in a specific area, but you want to train them in such a way that, wherever they are, they can actually be able to take care of people. And so that's where we're talking about international collaboration. So international collaboration is where, for example, here, having study abroad, partnering with schools in Nigeria to kind of do, things like exchange. We can even do virtual exchange where we will have students here do assessment, and the students in Nigeria will watch them do that, and then the ones here will watch the ones in Nigeria do like a teach back kind of deal. So that way we're collaborating and we're training, we're training everybody.
Dr. Modupe Adebayo is the chairperson for the Board of Trustees of the Yoruba Nurses of North America. She spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. In Sierra Leone, a community-led initiative on the remote Turtle Island is planting mangroves to mitigate coastal erosion and rising sea levels. The archipelago consists of 8 islands located in the Atlantic Ocean in the Bonthe district of southern Sierra Leone. For VOA reporter Eric Kawa recently visited the islands and reports.
It's a busy day here in the Turtle Islands, where fishermen are preparing for their work. The residents of the islands that make up the archipelago depend on fishing for survival. Fisherman Abubakar Kroma says erosion and rising sea levels affect their operations.
Sometimes they like high water could change power.
Kroma says sometimes when there are high tides, they go to sea only to come back and realize that the area has been enclosed by water. So they wait for a while and later they take the risk to come to shore. Sometimes, he says, the boat will capsize. Other times, the boat will get destroyed. At times, they sail peacefully while, he says, people on the land wait to rescue us from the boats.
As you stand and hold the boat, it's up direct.
Fishermen aren't the only ones facing the consequences of rising sea levels. Fishmongers and other residents also struggling. Hawagbato sells fish in Yile, one of the archipelago's islands.
People are not going to get a chance for going to sea.
Bato says when it rains, people are unable to go to sea, and they only survive in Yile town when people can go to the sea. And when the sea level rises, it destroys their business structures, and they have nowhere to live. Environmental experts say the island is at risk due to erosion. Edward Aruna works with the Reptiles and Amphibians Program, a non-profit environmental organization. The group is planting mangroves, trees, and shrubs that thrive in marshy sea coast to help fight erosion.
I want to tell people, mangroves help so much. So that is the reason why I'm presently engaging communities to be able to plant mangroves. Or planting trees, sometimes they act as windbreaks. Sometimes, where there are mangroves, you hardly see it being battered in such a way that is happening on areas that haven't got plants or mangroves.
A warming climate, which scientists say is caused by carbon fuel emissions, means sea levels are rising. At the same time, storms and surging tides are more common in many coastal areas. Aruna told the VOA that there are fears some of these islands could be lost to rising sea levels in the next 20 to 30 years. The town chief of Baki Island, Chief Mohamed Sisi, says anyone found guilty of cutting mangroves down will face severe penalties.
Personal for cut mangroves. The mangroves, now they stop that water, they
He says no one should cut the mangroves. The mangroves prevent the water from rising in their community. So if people cut the mangroves, the water will come and destroy the town. Also, he says no one should cut the big trees. On Say Island, more than 1,000 mangrove stands have been planted. About 500 stands have also been planted on Moot Island. In Gbangba Tok, on the coast of Sierra Leone's mainland, more than 2,000 mangrove stands are being grown. There are more efforts on the way to protect other shorelines in the Turtle Islands along with other areas. This is Eric Awa reporting for VOA Africa on Turtle Islands, Bond District, Sierra Leone.
Chad's military says it has deployed several hundred troops along the border with Cameroon to stop rebels from abducting civilians after armed men kidnapped a dozen Cameroonians, including a popular traditional ruler, this week. Chad's military has freed the kidnapped victims, but says troops need civilian help to stop a wave of local intercommunal violence. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
The latest wave of violence between the Mosei and Masak communities erupted in border areas late last month on November 28. Officials in Cameroon say that since then, several hundred civilians have been reluctant to return to the Gobo district, located along the Central African state's northern border with Chad. Many civilians have fled to safer towns and villages. 43-year-old cattle rancher Timothée Wundai is one of the displaced civilians. He says he, his wife and three children found refuge at the Gobo district village of Yakreo. Wundai says tensions degenerated into ongoing violence after a member of the Mosei community was killed and had his goats stolen. He says Mosei community members launched attacks on their Masa community neighbors using weapons, including guns, machetes, and bow and arrows to kill civilians. He says Mosei community members also accuse Masak community members of regularly stealing cattle. Military officials in Cameroon say at least five people have been killed and scores wounded amid the violence between the two communities. Both communities say about 13 people have died so far, with several dozen houses torched. When the conflict began, civilians said Vutu Tairia, the traditional ruler of Bugudum village, and a dozen civilians were abducted and taken to Chad. Chadian officials say Vutu was rescued from captivity by government troops, flown to Cameroon in a Chadian military helicopter, and handed to Cameroon's military and government officials this week. Authorities in Chad have provided no details about where and how the traditional ruler and the others were rescued. Officials say Vutsu and the freed civilians were given free medical care. Abdelkerim Said Bush is governor of Mayo-Kébi East, an administrative region in Chad. He says Chad deployed troops on its side of the border Wednesday to stop rebels and armed gangs from abducting civilians and crossing with weapons into Mayo-Kébi East. Abdelkerim says after handing Vutsu to Cameroon officials, he is launching a fervent appeal to civilians on both sides of the Chad-Cameroon border to help restore peace by reporting armed men and strangers hiding among civilians in towns and villages to government troops and administrative officials. Abdelkerim adds that Chad is very concerned about the ongoing violence because weapons are illegally circulating across the porous border and can be used by armed gangs to destabilize communities. Meanwhile, Mijiyawa Bakari, the governor of Cameroon's far north region, says troops have also been deployed on the Cameroon side of the border to make sure that armed gangs and criminals escaping Chad's military onslaught do not find safety on Cameroon's territory. He says armed men responsible for the fresh wave of violence along the border will be punished. Accusations of cattle stealing and violence have plagued relations between the Massa and Mosaic communities for years. Cameroon says President Paul Biya has dispatched a delegation to negotiate peace between the two communities. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
My radio can say my love for you is authentic. Will never end cause it's plenty. The more the girls wanna get me. For me, baby, you are the best. My head, my shoulder down to my belly. Your love is sweet, wanna twist it. Because you see me with Katie. It's not enough to leave me.
Yeah. Don't follow for the game where they play my advice. You go say I. 20 color for my. da 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 da.
Yo, Kelly.
Ridiculous them, sink is the Trinidad. Pick up the will of them. Come on, get a no idea. Anything I do, headline news. If you're waiting, I know, dude, I'm gonna say I do. Nothing but the truth, and I step up in the booth. No lie, my life, no be smart. Remember last Christmas, Santa Claus gave me the glizzy with the switch dog. So some people no go see this Christmas. Man, them are crosses, most of them not even Christians. Click bang, body sinking at the quicksand. See, tech full of bomb like Afghanistan.
And if you hear me kai, come in on the enemy, them a pre, I mean, other than a sorry for me. People are ball and a skin, can we bad than we mean? Bloody crime scene, calamity. I saw we shoot out green, figure Canada G. Make them have our experience, no gravity.
Tell them when I laugh up, when I dead dog. Violate people are dead dog. Should I keep in your bed, cuz? The Taliban's them a med work. When I laugh up, when I dead dog. Badness are where we end us. When I shoot people, we end up in a red cross.
No Taliban's like them, me, we are sure guns. Make you not sleep at your yard in a 4 months. And so we make people a mourn out. Like y'all get down a house. Laugh bars full of care that me sure about. And if you see me travel with a 9X, I know no politician with me, I go vote out. 4 killer, 4 seat and 4 rounds.
Them on the tea like Lipton, and let the best boom boom they are Kingston. So me buy a Birkin for Jada Kingdom. Some people vex on my phone, get bring down. Me too rich now, so me buy 6 more. What's the plan? Cause I'm real to my skeleton. If you insult my intelligence, then I make the sparks fly like electrician. Lock off traffic, car tragic, pair panicking. Freeze up like mannequin, as you can't manage when pellets them traveling.
Tell up the real life. No tech talk. All your people are dead dog. You should have keep in your bed, cause the Taliban's them a make quack. We no laugh, oh, we no tech talk. Badness are what we end us. We no shoot people, we end up in a red grass.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Magbill Yabaru, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you are not familiar with the road, never walk barefooted. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.
Far away, far away. Me, I know they do again. And I am looking for a seat.